known among medical missions than that of Richard Reinbold. I can tell you several things about Richard. One, he doesn't operate on the world's economy. He is a very talented physician, could be making the mega bucks in the United States of America. No doubt, no question. But he feels called and led by God to share his life among an extremely poor people in Guatemala. And for that, I respect him and love him a great deal. I have a friend in this congregation that we meet together regularly, and he's always sharing neat little things with me. One of the things he told me one time, that somebody defined sacrifice as being giving up something good for something better. I believe that the lives of Richard and Karen Reinbold and their children define sacrifice. But they're giving up something good for something better. The sharing of their lives and the message of Jesus Christ with people who live in darkness. Literally, folks, they put their lives on the line every day in Guatemala. We're blessed by having the Reinbolds with us. It's an honor to have Richard come and share with us what's going on in that nation, what's going on among the brethren there. It's an honor to lift him up in prayer before the Father, because many of us in this room, including myself, don't know what it's like to put our lives on the line for the faith. But the Reinbolds do. And so tonight, the missions committee and our eldership has invited Richard to share with us. And we're grateful for the privilege of listening. So with that, Richard, if you'll come up, I'll dress you up so you can fire.
I don't know, it's sort of, don't know what to say. Sometimes I'm sort of flabbergasted. I really feel like I'm basically doing what I enjoy doing and trying to live for Jesus each day. And I don't know. Anyway, it's a real privilege to be here with you. Karen and I have many wonderful memories of our time in Oklahoma City, and we appreciate many of you so much. It's a great honor to be here, and we are thankful to the elders and the missions committee for being able to share with you tonight. I'm not a great speaker. I was going to be a preacher, but couldn't speak, so I went on to medical school, and I will share with you a few things this evening, and then we'll talk about Guatemala and show some pictures. One of the things that's hurt me a lot is not being a preacher, is knowing the Bible as well as I should. And the other day, one of the elders from Falls Church cornered me and gave me a Bible quiz before he let me go to Guatemala. And one of the questions I missed was the name of the only car mentioned in the Bible. And I don't know whether any of you know that or not, but it's Acts 1:14. The apostles were in all in one accord. And so elders can be difficult at times. I'm going to talk to you about Guatemala. We've already had several questions tonight. Why are we going back, and is it safe, and whatever. Before I do talk about Guatemala, I wanted to share with you some reasons that people gave for having an automobile accident. And I hope that our reasons for going to Guatemala make more sense than these reasons. But this actually occurred, and an insurance company got these reasons in the mail for the accidents that their clients had. The first person reported to the company that the pedestrian had no idea which way to go, so I ran over him. The second one they reported was this: the other car collided with mine without warning me of its intentions. A third driver said, I've been driving my car for 40 years when I fell asleep at the wheel and had an accident. A fourth driver said, as I reached an intersection, a hedge sprung up, obscuring my vision. The one I like the best is the fifth one. The driver said, I pulled away from the side of the road, glanced at my mother-in-law, and headed for the embankment. The sixth man reported the guy was all over the road. I had to swerve a number of times before I hit him. And the last guy reported an invisible car came out from nowhere, struck my car, and vanished. Well, I trust that what we're going to say about Guatemala is more relevant and makes more sense than those things. Before we talk about it, let's look at a couple of scriptures. The first one is in Luke chapter 4. As Jesus started his ministry, he picked up the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and he read to his hometown people in the synagogue, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and the recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." So we see Jesus' ministry as being one not only of preaching the word, verbalizing the message, but one of demonstrating the changing of lives, the meeting of needs, the helping of those who are sick and disabled. And in Matthew 11, John the Baptist is concerned. He's not sure whether Jesus really is the Messiah or not. So he sends some of his disciples to Jesus with this question: "Are you he who is to come, or shall we look for another?" John apparently was not sure. And Jesus answered them with this statement: "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk. The lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. And the poor, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have the good news preached to them. And blessed is he who takes no offense at me." So in both descriptions here of Jesus' ministry, there was a preaching of the gospel and a meeting of the physical needs of mankind. And that's what we're trying to do in Guatemala, and we're very grateful to many of you and to this congregation in making that ministry possible. For those of you who don't know about Guatemala, and if you haven't watched any of President Reagan's reports, it's a country located 2 hours directly south of New Orleans. If you go by road, it's 1,500 miles from Brownsville, Texas. In 1959, there were no congregations of the Churches of Christ meeting in Guatemala, and several missionaries, Jerry Hill was one of them, began working in that country. He was later joined by Joe Lee, never really more than three or four men and their wives working among the Spanish-speaking people until recently. Pat Heil went to work with Jerry and Joe and the others in 1967. Karen and I went and spent some time in 1968. We learned a lot from these brothers. They taught us a lot. And during that time, we saw the work that they were doing. We saw the tremendous outreach and were greatly blessed by the work that was taking place among the Spanish-speaking people. Today, there are over 200 congregations of the Churches of Christ meeting in Guatemala among Spanish-speaking people. But Pat Heil, myself, and several other fellows and our wives began working among the Maya Indians of western Guatemala in 1970. Guatemala's population is divided. Half the population speaks Spanish. The other half speak one of 27 different Indian languages. Their per capita income is about $800 to $1,000 a year. And ours is between $10,000 and $12,000 a year. There's a very high unemployment rate in that country. It has the second highest infant mortality rate in the Western Hemisphere. The first state we went into had 250,000 people, and there were two physicians besides myself working with these people. But things are changing in that country, and that's why we're here today, and that's why we're planning to go back. A tremendous thing is taking place. Some people have coined the expression DAWN, D-A-W-N, discipling a whole nation. People, as they look at this, I'm talking about the experts in missions, find Guatemala to be one of the most receptive countries in the world. There's a tremendous interest in spiritual things there among all classes of people, the wealthy, the poor, the teenagers, the old. Everyone's interested in the gospel. Because of the political, social, and religious situation, many things are changing there. Many Roman Catholics are listening to our radio programs which you are helping to finance, and many other religious programs because they're changing. They're looking for a new way. The Roman Catholics have been betrayed by their own clergy. A military in Guatemala has actually shot priests in foxholes with machine guns and grenades, prepared to attack them. And they have been a Roman Catholic country for so long, but now they feel that their own clergy has betrayed them. And this is one of the reasons, the many reasons that people are saying, hey, I want to leave this religion. And they are leaving. The Indian groups that we're working with are very, very responsive to the gospel. We'll show you some slides and information on that. In fact, there's a Greek word that's being used to point out what's happening in Guatemala. It's the word kairos. This means a specially appointed time. And many feel that God has prepared Guatemala for a great harvest that's going to be greater than it's been so far. And we feel that we cannot ignore this harvest and that we need to really do our best at this time of tremendous receptivity. To give you some idea of what's happened in the last 25 years, in 1959, there were 5% of the people at the most worshiping among Protestant churches. Today, it's 25%. One-fourth of the population of Guatemala has changed religions in the last 25 years. To give you a frame of reference, Ecuador has 1% Protestant population today. I was talking to Howard Norton this morning, and he estimates that there are 5 or 6% of Brazilians have left Roman Catholicism. So it's a fairly significant population of people that are changing. Our team began concentrating among the Mayas in 1970, and we worked for 3 years before anyone was led to Christ. Today, we'll show you some of the pictures of the brethren and the congregations. There are over 35 congregations meeting, and well over 1,000 people have been baptized into Christ who are faithful. Last year, even in our absence, the brothers baptized 200 people into Jesus. Well, working in Guatemala is unique in a number of ways. First of all, from the very beginning, the brethren were taught to support their own work, to support their own preachers, to be sort of self-sufficient. They build their own buildings, they propagate, they teach the gospel, and they lead the way. The missionaries we have served mainly as catalysts or to meet special needs. As you will see in the pictures, we have a number of things that we're doing from the medical viewpoint or the physical viewpoint. We have medical clinics, and these are being carried on today by the paramedics that you'll see in the pictures. We've worked in preventive medicine. We've worked with agricultural projects and nutrition and water systems and certain kinds of technology which will improve the life of these people. The clinic has a very positive effect for Christ. And these are some of the ways that it works. First, just by loving people, by giving them care, by showing that you're concerned about them, opens them up to the gospel of Christ. Second, they've heard many sermons in recent years, but when you help them get well, you help a grandmother who has been dying to get relief and to be able to be with her family again, when you help a working man who has a family to be able to work again, these things open their hearts. It authenticates what they hear from our evangelists and on the radio programs, and they want to become Christians. Thirdly, the clinics have opened up communities. When we first went into this area, many of the people had never seen a white man before. In fact, in Guatemala, the boogeyman, the guy you don't want to be around, has red hair and white face and white skin. And here I was walking up and down the trails with people screaming and running the other way, and I didn't really know what it was until I got further into the culture and found out what a boogeyman is in Guatemala. And here I was. So we've opened doors to evangelism in communities where there were no Protestant group, no one had really ever shared the liberating gospel of Christ. We've gone into these communities, and there are now churches meeting and worshiping God. And the fourth thing that we've been doing that I think is very advantageous, and especially with the political situation, we've been training brethren to be paramedics, to be an agricultural worker. We've been giving them skills that they can serve themselves, the people in their communities. It allows them to be able to support themselves, and it allows them to be of service to the people in their community. A way that has helped us in this work is that most of our staff are trained to meet the physical and the spiritual needs. For example, Pat Howell, I trained him how to give penicillin shots, and I've learned how to preach a little bit. But we've got brothers and sisters there who are able to meet those needs, both physical and spiritual. And for example, Tanya Howard was a nurse, a very effective nurse, and she was able to carry out many of medical duties, but she was also able to read the Word of God and share with her patients about Christ. So that's sort of a background and for the work in Guatemala, and I think the pictures that will take a few minutes will give you a better idea than I'm able to give with this speech, and then I'll share a few more things with you.
Let's see here.
Well, satisfaction from knowing that you've been a part of this work and that your prayers and generosity have helped many, many people. And we're very happy that we've been able to share with you tonight about the work in Guatemala. As we return on the 4th of August, Lord willing, we have a number of needs that we want to share with you. First and foremost, we cherish your prayers for the brethren. Many, many times as I visited there in the last year and a half, they particularly asked for the brethren in America to pray for their safety and well-being as they serve Jesus Christ among a situation that is often hostile to them. We cherish your prayers for our family and for our strength to meet the needs of these people. Perhaps the most difficult thing for me is not the working conditions or whatever, but it's the little 2- and 3- and 4-year-old children who come into me weighing 9, 10, 11, 12 pounds, who are destined to an early death, and it's very difficult to help them. But I know, have you ever had that opportunity to work with infants and children who suffer like these kiddos do? But that's really the hardest thing for me, and I cherish your prayers as we try and meet the needs of these youngsters and their families. We cherish your prayers for evangelists. We feel like the situation is a tremendous one for evangelism. We realize that there are many congregations that have been started, but we feel like the harvest is such that we need to concentrate on this harvest as this door is open. And as you're well aware, all of Central America may become part of the communist bloc before long, and it'd be great to have the strongest church that we can have in that part of the world. And because they will face extreme difficulty in the future if the political situation continues as it is going. And I feel that we should continue to work and harvest the crop that the Lord has prepared there. I don't like to talk about finances, but I'll just mention that we are looking at least an additional $4,000 a month in coming up in November as we begin to open up the clinics. We'll be treating anywhere from 800 to 1,000 people per month, and medicine is getting a lot more expensive. We're looking at the need of $3,000 in one-time gifts for a vehicle for the clinic. We've raised most of that already. And we're also very much in need of a school teacher. Our local school that Brother Keck spoke at, we lack just one teacher for this coming year, and that's a math teacher. And so we'll be completely equipped if we can raise the funds and find these teachers and evangelists that we need. So that's what we wanted to share with you. I want to tell you a story about a missionary in Africa as a closing statement, and perhaps there will be some who want to respond to the gospel tonight. John Clark was a missionary working in Zaire, which in the old days was Belgian Congo. And one day, John Clark and his fellow Africans were out hunting. In those days, Africans, missionaries, did not have refrigerators, and they had to hunt for food, for meat, every few days. And this particular day, John Clark came upon a lion dragging an African through the weeds. And being a good shot, and I guess that was a criteria in those days to be a good missionary in Africa, he shot the lion, rescued this man who was mangled. He was delirious. He had apparently been drug around for some time. And John Clark nourished that man back to health over a period of 3 to 4 months. In those days, there were no plastic surgeons. There were no antibiotics or IV fluids. It was just a matter of TLC in the home. And John Clark and his wife ministered to this African's needs for a number of months and finally got him well. And the day came for him to leave. He went back to his village, and months passed, and John Clark heard nothing further about this African whose life he'd saved. But one evening, it was almost night, he heard a noise out in the clearing. In those days, and even today, my African missionary friends tell me that they clear an area around the house so that if a snake or a wild animal comes in near the house, they'll know about it. And they put chickens in the yard, and the chickens start squawking, and they know somebody's there or something's there. So this night, the squawking occurred, and Mr. Clark went out to look, and there was a group of people and some animals and children, and he didn't know what to make of it. They were at the edge of the clearing. So he walked out towards this group of people and animals, and he found out or recognized someone, and it was the man whose life he'd saved and whose life he had brought back to health. And the man got up and made this statement to John Clark. It's a statement that I feel I've gained tremendously from it. It's helped me to look at my life and to look at my relationship to Jesus Christ. So the African said this: "It is the law of the forest and of my tribe that when a man has been attacked by a lion and has had his life saved by another, he no longer belongs to himself. He belongs to his Savior. The lion was about to eat me, and you saved me. So here am I. All that I am belongs to you. My wives are your wives. My children are your children. My possessions are your possessions. I am your life." Tonight, can we say to Jesus, as the African said to Mr. Clark, "I am your life"? Having seen the needs of Guatemala, and as you see the needs around you in this area, do you consider your lives and your finances, your personal professional training, your time in relationship to Jesus Christ? Do you look at yourself and what you have in relationship to the cross? Are we taking Jesus and our mission for him seriously? I pray that we are and that we will continue to do so. So tonight, did someone save you and me? Are all that we have his, our life, our family, our possessions? If not, why not come to Jesus now as we stand and sing?
those of you who are visiting this morning, let me say just a brief word of introduction. We're involved in the study of John's Gospel. Last Lord's Day, we completed our study of John 17, where Jesus completed his upper room discourse by praying for himself, for his disciples, and for us, those who would believe in their message. This morning, as we move to chapter 18, we move from a place of quietness and solitude and privacy to a place that there's going to be chaos and confusion and loud noises and pain. But this morning, as we reach the 18th chapter of John, we come to a place where he's no longer in the upper room along with his 11 disciples. We find him going through the arrest and through the trials that ultimately would lead to his crucifixion. The Bible tells us in John 18, verse 1, when Jesus had finished praying, he left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. The Kidron Valley lay on the eastern side of the city where the brook Kidron would flow through it. As Jesus would come down the Kidron Valley and step over the small brook Kidron, he would find there a gruesome reminder of what awaited him in just a few hours. Because during Passover week, some 250,000 lambs were slain and their blood splattered upon the altar, and aqueducts would take that blood down from the altar in the temple down to the brook Kidron, where the brook Kidron would take it on out of the city. And so as Jesus leaves the upper room with his disciples, comes down the Kidron Valley and steps over the brook Kidron, he would have been stepping over something that looked blood red as the brook Kidron took the blood of the lambs out of the city. He went from there up into the Mount of Olives, into the Garden of Gethsemane. John, through inspiration of the Spirit, has seen fit to leave that out. But the synoptics tell us that it was there in that garden before the arrest that Jesus went through the most agonizing hours of his entire life. The Bible tells us that as he took his disciples, he took three of his closest ones, Peter, James, and John, and he separated with them, and he made the statement to those men, "My soul is extremely sorrowful, even to the point of death." And the Bible says he removed himself even from them, about a stone's throw away, and he fell to the ground. Word in the original language in Luke's gospel that talks about his going to the ground was the kind of throwing oneself to the ground in utter grief and despair. And folks, I want you to know something. That is the Son of God on his face in the garden. There beneath those olive trees in the darkness of the night, Jesus wept and prayed and struggled and poured out his life that he might make the decision to go to Calvary. Luke tells us that as he was there going through such agony and stress, he sweat as if it were great drops of blood falling to the ground. I have in my library a copy of a physician's study that was done. And it reported that in extreme cases of stress, that the capillaries near the surface of the skin would burst, and that the blood would literally ooze through the pores of the skin. That Jesus was under such tremendous stress and such tremendous anxiety. Luke tells us as he began to perspire, it was like great drops of blood falling to the ground. And he prayed, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." When Jesus emerged from his hour of prayer with the Father, the decision had been made. He came forth with the victorious conclusion, "To Calvary I'll go." The Bible tells us in John 18, verse 2, "Now Judas, who betrayed him." The synoptics tell us that it was 30 pieces of silver that Judas betrayed him for. 30 pieces of silver. That was between $20 and $25 in our currency. It was also the price of a cheap slave in the days of Jesus. That Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples of Jesus, betrayed him for the price of a cheap common slave that was sold every day in the marketplace. The Bible says Judas knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Yes, Judas knew the place because Judas had often been there in the presence of Jesus when Jesus had taught and prayed. It wasn't any surprise to Judas that he'd find him in the garden. Judas had been there. Isn't it amazing that here is one who stayed in the company of this holy man Jesus for 3 years? He'd seen the miracles. He'd seen the love that had come forth from Jesus. He'd heard the teachings. He'd seen the sacrifice. He'd seen the time and time again that Jesus had ministered to other people. And although he'd been in the presence of Jesus and in the presence of disciples who loved Jesus and in that holy place, if you will, of the Garden of Gethsemane and heard Jesus pray and commune with the Father, nothing had touched his heart. Judas was still in the dark and in the cold. Folks, I find a very appropriate word of application for you and me. You can come into this holy place every week, week in, week out. You can be in the presence of holy people week in, week out. You can partake of the Lord's Supper. You can read the Bible. You can be in the presence of people who are good influences on you and still be in the dark and the cold because you have never really submitted your life to Jesus Christ. Because your heart has really never been changed. But like Judas, you're still lording it over your own life rather than submitting to Jesus. Judas came to the grove guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches and lanterns and weapons. The word translated detachment or cohort, maybe in your translation, is a word that meant the tenth part of a Roman legion. A Roman legion was composed of between 5,000 and 6,000 troops, which means that as Judas comes to arrest Jesus and leads a detachment, a cohort, a tenth part of a Roman legion,